It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Raindrops keep falling on my head.
Well, that ought to do it.
And just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed.
Think you use enough dynamite there, Butch?
Nothing seems to fit.
Listen, I don't mean to be a sore loser, but when it's done, if I'm dead, kill him. Love to.
Raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling.
I never shot anybody before.
One hell of a time to tell me.
So I just did me some talking to the sun.
I'll jump first. I can't swim!
Why, are you crazy? The fall will probably kill you.
Oh. I said I didn't like the way he got things done.
Paul Newman is Butch Cassidy. And the Sundance Kid is Robert Redford. Catherine Ross is Etta Place.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am, as almost always, joined by my good buddy, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is great to be here.
It's great to have you back. And if you're listening and you don't know what I'm talking about, since Sean joined the show, I believe I did the first episode at all that he wasn't a part of. And I got to tell you, it was fun doing the episode. I liked the episode, but I think Sean's absence is felt, and I'm glad to have him back. Those of you who listened to the Honeymooners episode that we did, you will notice the absolute lack of Sean. So, and that's really only because Sean had to do this thing, what do they call it, work? while we were recording it, and he couldn't get himself free to do it. But again,
I'm excited to listen to the episode, though. So that part's exciting for me.
Well, by the time people listen to this, you will have listened to that episode. But today we are honoring, we're a little delayed in doing so, with his passing, we are honoring Robert Redford. And now we've done the natural on the show. We've done some Marvel movies that he had, you know, minor appearances in. But I think that's it for Robert Redford so far. So today we're going to do Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which has been, for many, many years, one of my absolute favorite movies of all time. I've seen it many, many times. It's funny because I had a talk, when we were talking about the Honeymooners, we talked somewhat about when I first got a VCR and I was taping Honeymooners episodes. The first day I had a VCR, which I believe was in 1982 or so, that evening, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was on TV, and I recorded it and sat there and cut out the commercials. So that was the first movie I ever recorded. That was the first movie I ever had for home viewing. And it's, like I said, it's long been one of my favorites. This is, I went into this for today thinking, I don't even need to see this movie. I've seen it so many times. But I watched it last night with my wife, and I watched it for the purposes of providing a review of it. And I have to tell you, my opinion, my personal opinion hasn't changed, but my reviewer's opinion is slightly different. I always view this as one of the greatest movies of all time and flawless. And I think I saw some chinks in the armor when I watched it yesterday. So we'll talk about some of them. I don't think it's going to change, again, my personal opinion, but it may change my review slightly. So what's your history with this, Sean?
So I'm in a very different place than you. I swore I saw it. I haven't. I've seen clips of it. You mentioned it being on television, commercial television and things like that. I know I've seen, you know, jumped in partway through and seen it. Always liked everything I saw. I have never seen this in its entirety, which is shocking to me because of the fact that it's the kind of movie I love. So it, my wife and I watched it together, and then I watched it again a second time for the purpose of, you know, this particular recording. It was, for both of us, a pretty cold viewing. And there's a lot to talk about here. So I'm actually going to be speaking to it from seeing it in 2025. And how the movie watches today, seeing it fresh versus having the nostalgia for it, because I didn't watch it in the past. So it's interesting.
Absolutely. And I'll start off with just kind of background a little bit for when this is made. This came out in 1969. So this would have been, you know, at the very beginning of when, you know, this the 70s feel for movies. Which was different than the 60s feel, and it's different than the 80s feel. The 70s feel is very, very distinct. And this almost feels like it's a bridge between the earlier movies and that, because of the anti-hero thing. It goes kind of with the, which came out the same year, The Wild Bunch, or I think the year before, or possibly 2 years before, Bonnie and Clyde, you know, the anti-heroes and that kind of thing. But this is slightly different. Well, this, I would say there's a similar feel to Bonnie and Clyde for the most part, because this is definitely presenting the heroes as fun. And mm-hmm. they're villains, but they're fun. There's a lot to this, because it's not a true story, but it's based on a true story. A lot of what's played here is legend, and I don't think they make any bones about it. I don't think they try to say this is absolutely fact and this is the way it happened. I think they played a little fast and loose with the facts, and you know, that's fine with me, as long as they're not trying to pretend it's a historically accurate movie, and I don't think they are doing that in this one. Again, I saw this, I remember seeing it when it first came on TV, and you know, there was things that were edited for television, and the editing for television back in the 1970s was a little bit more strict than it is now. There's things in this movie that would just make it onto regular TV without a problem now, that back then they had to cut out. It's not an especially violent movie, so that separates it a little bit from The Wild Bunch right there. Sam Peckinpah, I don't think Sam Peckinpah has ever made a movie that wasn't violent. This is George Roy Hill directing it. It's the first time together for Robert Redford and Paul Newman. And eventually, Sean and I are going to cover The Sting, which is their second time together. And it's very, very different in their relationship to each other and the presentation of the characters. And just, I think when we get to that, we're going to be able to see a little bit more of the quality of the acting. Not so much because the acting is better, but because the characters are so different that we're going to see how these two actors, you know, are able to get into the role that they're playing so much, that they are they are embodying two different people, even though they're together. You know, when you see an Abbott and Costello movie, they're Abbott and Costello every time, no matter what. You see a Robert Redford and Paul Newman movie, there's only two of them, but they are very different characters in their two movies. Yes. And I kind of like that, and I like that as a comparison. And again, we'll get more into that probably when we talk about The Sting. For now, we'll talk about this one.
The two good choices to do, because of the fact that I think they're an example of an acting masterclass, where you're really not seeing Paul Newman and Robert Redford, you're seeing the characters. I love the Abbott and Costello comparison, because I think that's pretty key when you take a look at that. And I love Abbott and Costello, but that's what you want from an Abbott and Costello. You want them to be Abbott and Costello. In this case, you want these two guys to be characters. And I think the characters in this movie are really good to talk about.
And when you think about it from that perspective, it's interesting to try and put it into, to try and think about what it was in 1969. Because in 2025, or by the, well, this will be out in 2025, I believe, not quite 2026 yet. In 2025, Paul Newman and Robert Redford are icons of the movie industry. And I'm pretty sure that in 1969, they were as well. Certainly Paul Newman was. I think Robert Redford might have been still on his way up at this point. But I was trying to, when I was watching it, I was trying to think, if I was, say, 20 years old in 1969 when this came out, would I be looking at this and saying, ah, two pretty boys? Or would I be taking it on and seeing it for what it really is, which is what I do now? But when you see people who are so iconic in just their own stardom, for them to pull themselves into a role and not have you think of them as the real people is not an easy task. And I think they do that really, really well. I think they embody these characters. And I think the characters are kind of well-defined. I mean, you have Butch Cassidy, who's kind of a dreamer. He's not particularly violent, but he's also, you know, he espouses his distaste for hard work. And he's, you know, he's willing to take the shortcuts to get there, which is where, you know, where they became bank robbers. And then you have the Sundance Kid. And if you know, you know, I did look a little bit into their real backgrounds. The Sundance Kid was a very violent guy in real life. He was a stone cold killer. And that's not what Robert Redford portrays. In fact, you have to look a little harder to some of the underlying way in that he's playing the character to really see that. It's in there. His ability to kill is there. Like when they're in their final scene, and or close to the final scene, and it comes to the point where they actually have to kill people, he's ready to do it. He's okay with it. It doesn't seem to bother him. And that's when Butch says, "Well, you know, I've never actually killed anybody before. It's a hell of a time to tell me." But it's you know, from the opening scene with Sam Elliott when he's being accused of cheating, there's that underlying seething nature where he would kill Sam Elliott in the right situation if it presented. He doesn't necessarily want to. And that's important, too, to make you like the character. He doesn't want to kill him. But if he feels his back is against the wall, it's done.
Oh, he was ready to. And I liked that he was at the ready. And I'm with you. He didn't want to do it. But it was very, very clear that he was reading the room. And Sam Elliott was not going to survive that if that was the way. Actually, if Butch Cassidy hadn't stepped in, I think that's where it would have gone.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. Absolutely. Butch Cassidy came in and defused it. My interesting trivia, which I think I've said on the show before, but I'm not 100%, is that Sam Elliott is now married to Catherine Ross. They were both in this movie, and they never met each other because they're not in any scenes together. They didn't meet each other till years later. So just an interesting little trivia tidbit. And mentioning Catherine Ross, first of all, Catherine Ross in this movie is absolutely gorgeous. Yes. You could see where they have the attraction to her. They both have. There's a dynamic to their relationship that I find really fascinating because, you know, my wife had never seen this and we watched it the other night. And she was like, what's up with the three of them? I said, they all three love each other. But it's not a menage a trois sexual relationship. The sexual relationship is between her and the Sundance Kid, but the love relationship is between all of them. Butch and Sundance love each other. Butch and Etta love each other. Sundance and Etta love each other. There's no question. And that's not an easy dynamic to play without it feeling a little weird.
I liked actually when it did. And let me explain that. There is a relationship between her and Butch Cassidy that shows that she's getting something from that relationship emotionally that she can't get from Sundance Kid. He starts to get there at certain points in time, but sometimes his reactions to her, what he says to her, and things like that. He reminds me a lot of, this is the comic geek in me, he's got kind of a Wolverine vibe about him at times, which I actually really love to say that about Robert Redford because he's not a character I think of as being that archetype. But I love that an actor I think of, you know, playing those type of roles. But in this one, he has the right edge. We talk about quality acting in this one. I'm not used to, I can't think of films before where Robert Redford has played this kind of character. And he's the badass in this. And it's not about killing left and right. It's the atmosphere, the tone, the way he carries himself. But his interactions with her, he's still that guy. It's clear he cares about her. Clearly, I would even say that to a certain extent, he even loves her. But the kind of expression of that love is very, very different than what she is getting from Butch Cassidy. And it was, there's parts of where it's like, ooh, I don't, like, if she was dating me, I would not be so comfortable with that. And I like that there were a few scenes where it was really apparent, like, there was a slight thing between Butch and Sundance. It was subtle. It wasn't overdone. But I just liked the acting in it because of the fact that there were some points where I'm like, they know it too. And I feel like it felt very real, if I'm making any sense at all. And I feel that's quality acting, where you've embodied the characters and embodied the situation in such a way that I love that we're talking about this, because I feel it's a very, you know, if you were looking at two friends that were in this situation, we'd be having conversations about it. And I feel like that's something where this movie, because of the script and because of the story that was being told, it felt very authentic, because I'm like, yeah, this feels real. Like, I got my friends and they're doing this weird stuff.
But it also, I think it takes it to a relationship that very, very few people have.
Yes.
I don't think there are very many people out there who are so close with their best friend, mm-hmm, that they're comfortable with them essentially wooing your love, which is what's going on. And, you know, that whole scene with the bicycle, you know, they're clearly, they have an intimate relationship that's almost romantic. And that would be Butch and Edda. And, you know, Sundance and Edda obviously have a romantic relationship. And then he comes out, you know, what are you doing? Oh, I'm stealing your woman. Go ahead, take her. But you know he doesn't mean it. Because he trusts that he knows what their relationship is. And he knows that it's not a sexual relationship. And we have scenes in there where Butch is with other women. We don't have any scenes where Sundance is with other women.
Right.
He does have a monogamous relationship with her, which is kind of strange. And when you think about these characters, you would think that they would just be rousing all the time and doing whatever. But I think that plays to that dynamic between the three of them. And I think it plays it well. And it's three actors who are just doing a phenomenal job with it. You know, you could see why she is so important to both of them.
I liked that when she ended up traveling with them, that they didn't romanticize how hard life on the run is. You know, because sometimes they overly do it and they make it seem like it's this. I like that it started off being this good thing until it wasn't. There was
off being horrible. They pull in and there's the pigs walking around. Maybe this is the New Jersey, what you call it, the Atlantic City, New Jersey of Bolivia.
Right.
But then they find their way and they start, you know, she's actually clearly in the montage scene of the robberies. She's actually enjoying it.
Yes. And then the idea of looking forward to life being this starts to wear on her. And I really liked the fact that felt real too. Not a lot of stories go there. You know, it's always, you know, straight on through to the end. The fact that she left with him and the fact that she went all in initially on that already said something about their relationship. And I loved that. But I loved that as they were on the road and things started getting more and more dire, I liked where it went, because I feel like that doesn't happen very often in film. And there was something to that that I was like, oh, that's different and real. It made the movie feel more real. You know, obviously this is based on true events, based. And that based word is a pretty, it needs to be like exclamation point off of that piece. But I, you know, I thought that they kept it as far as feeling. There was a realistic feeling a lot of times in this film where those things that they, the choices that they made, especially with her, I thought were things that added a reality to this in very, very subtle ways that just kept me engrossed and feeling like this was really happening as I was watching it.
Well, I think Sundance and Edda each have their little speech before they go to Bolivia that kind of lays it on the line and tells you where they're going to be.
Yeah.
You know, he gives a little speech about, you know, if you're going to come with us, it's going to be hard and you're going to have to deal with it, basically. And then she gives her speech, which I think is her shining moment in this movie, where mm-hmm. she says, you know, I'll come and I'll stitch your wounds and I'll help you and I'll do whatever. But there's one thing I won't do is I don't want to see you die. And I think ultimately when she leaves Bolivia and goes back to the States, that's because she sees that coming.
Yes.
They never say that, but I think she sees things are getting a little tight here and somehow this is going to end bloody, which is a theme throughout. And it's such a lighthearted movie as it's going along. And then for it to have that as a theme going through it, just it doesn't seem like it should work.
Right.
But when they go visit, or when they're running from the posse, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more, I'm sure, the super posse. But when they're running from the posse and they go to seek help from a sheriff that was, you know, they're acquainted with, you know, he comes out and says, you know, you guys are going to die bloody and it's not going to be pretty. You know, they come right out and say it. Again, not a Sam Peckinpah feeling movie, but certainly if Sam Peckinpah had made this movie, it would have a very, very different feeling, because there would be violence and blood throughout it. This is lighthearted. This is, this is almost a romantic comedy Western. There's definitely a lot of lighthearted moments in that make it fun, which is, you know, I know we're jumping around, but it also, I think, is reflected by the end that you don't actually see them die. And I think that's part of it. Oh, no, I don't think. But again, you know, just comparing it to movies of that era, you see Bonnie and Clyde die at the end. And that has a similar feel to it as it's going along, but that's a darker movie than this.
Yeah.
I think they wanted to try and avoid some of the darkness here.
Yeah, and I don't know that you needed it. I mean, it's funny, and I think you're right in mentioning the fact that this is not a movie that's violent throughout. Yet there's a sense of danger throughout, which is really intriguing, you know, especially when as we continue to talk about the posse and that type of thing. I mean, this sense of danger is something that's very, very real throughout it. But it's an example of you don't need to be killing everybody left and right in order to build a sense of danger. And I think that was very well done in this piece. I think when the killing does start, it needs to stand out as being different. And I feel like it did. You know, we knew they were done. I mean, the odds, you know, people were coming out left and right. You saw there was backup coming in. The sense at the end of the violence being like, oh, this is bad. I mean, this is really, really bad. And these guys probably aren't getting out of this. Was very, very well done because of the fact that that scene, I think, just stood out as being something that we didn't see throughout the entire film. You saw it really where you needed it to at the appropriate part, where they were backed against a wall that they couldn't possibly, there was nowhere to go, nowhere to go.
And they went out on their own terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was okay. This, you know, although they were defiant till the end, you know, after we get out of this, we're going to Australia. You know, there's I like the way Butch is always the planner, but yes. Butch isn't always right. You know, and Sundance is probably the one person who calls him on it. You know, you keep thinking, Butch, that's what you're good at. You know, that whole thing. He's probably the only person who questions him and his decision making. And, you know, this movie owes a lot to the charisma of the two stars.
Oh, yes.
Because I think if you had different people playing, originally, apparently they considered different people for the role of Sundance. I think Butch Cassidy was pretty much Paul Newman almost from the start. But the two people I saw that they considered for Sundance, I don't think either one of them would have played nearly as well. And one was Warren Beatty. And apparently he rejected it because he said it's too similar to Bonnie and Clyde. He's already done that.
That makes sense.
And the other was Steve McQueen, who apparently was totally on board with doing it with him. But I think Steve McQueen has a rougher edge to him than Redford. And I don't think he would have played that contrast between the stone cold killer and charismatic guy as well as I don't think he would have had that difference in the portrayal that I think was key to his charisma. to liking the character. I think Steve McQueen, I love Steve McQueen as an actor and all of that, but I think he would not have played Sundance as likable as Robert Redford did.
The chemistry between these two is undeniable. I mean, it they felt like genuine friends, which is really hard to pull off, because there comes a quick point in the film where you stop looking at them as Paul Newman and Robert Redford and start looking at them as Butch and Sundance. And I think that's really key when actors are able to transport you. And I feel like in this film, boy, they did that really well. You mentioned The Sting, which we're going to be watching. I'm not going to go heavy into it, but they do the same thing in The Sting. And I feel like that's a sign of talented actors when the characters, they're doing such an amazing job of portraying the characters. You are seeing the character in front of you and not, these are two incredibly well-known iconic actors. And to be able to say, I watched a film and I saw them as the characters says a lot about them.
One of the things people point to in judging acting performances, and I could see why this is so critical, is when you aren't speaking, when you're listening to someone else on the screen speaking, but you're still in the frame, how are you reacting? What are you doing? How do you look like you're really reacting to what they're saying, as opposed to thinking, okay, my line is coming up, let me do this. I thought in this movie, in this particular viewing, I noticed it much more. I saw a lot of that from Redford. I saw a lot of times when Paul Newman is speaking and he starts thinking about what Butch Cassidy is saying, and he's thinking, that's ridiculous. And then all of a sudden, you know, like you can almost see it popping into his face, and then he'll start laughing at him, or he'll kind of cock his head a little bit or do something. And I thought that just added to the performance so much. And it's something I hadn't really noticed when I just watched the movie for fun, but it's something that subtly will influence you when you're watching it to make it feel like they're embodying the characters. And again, like we mentioned earlier, these are such iconic actors that they need to do that little bit extra to make you feel that they are the characters that they're playing. And they do.
I listened to the Talkville podcast, which is Michael Rosenbaum and Tom Welling going through each episode of Smallville. And Michael Rosenbaum talked about some advice he got from John Glover, who was playing Lionel Luther on there, because he was having trouble on this scene. And John Glover stopped him and said, you need to just listen. And his point being, you're interacting. We're having this interchange between the two of us. You need to listen to it. And he played the scene differently after that, when he was actively listening to the other character. And I think it applies to this in the sense that it was very clear that Redford was doing that. And when you're listening, you're reacting the way that you should. It's taking you into the mood. And I thought it was so cool when you were talking about that right now. I'm like, oh yeah, that's it. And they were just talking about this on the other podcast I was listening to, where you had two actors talking about a scene where one was struggling until he took a breath and started actually listening to what the other character was saying and reacting the way you're supposed to react to what that character's doing in that moment. And I feel like that's something that we as the viewer, we don't always notice it, to your point, because it's something when you're enjoying a film, you're not always like getting really in depth on those things, but it's stuff that goes on in the back of your head that you don't realize is happening that is creating a sense of this is actually happening versus this is two people trading lines off. There's a difference between the two.
And when you're watching it for pure entertainment, which is how we watch most movies, and mm-hmm. Butch Cassidy is center screen or close up, and then the Sundance Kid is slightly back further, but he's still on the screen, and he's listening to what Butch Cassidy is saying, you're looking at Butch Cassidy because he's the one speaking. You're not focusing on the Sundance Kid. Yeah, but... Yeah. If you're watching it the right way, you're still picking it up in your head. You're still seeing it, even though you're not focusing on it. So it is, you know, somewhat subtle in how it affects your viewing, but I do think it affects your viewing, and it does affect how you do things. And I see things, you know, I could relate a little bit almost in podcasting, like when we do this. There are times, and I hate to admit this, but there are times when I know, you know, we're keeping a conversation going, and you can't have those dead spots in a conversation. So we're talking about one point, and I have to be thinking sometimes about, okay, what's the next thing we're going to talk about after we're done with this point? So I start thinking about that, and I might for a second miss what you're saying So therefore, if you're watching a video of it, I'm not reacting exactly to what you're saying. And that doesn't happen very often, Sean. Please don't feel like you're talking to nobody.
You gotta remember, I do the host thing too. So, I mean, I get that. You're trying to make sure the show keeps moving. So it's very true.
But, you know, in normal conversation, you don't have to do that. In normal conversation, you know, if you don't have a reaction or if you don't have something to say, you life goes on. But when you're doing, you know, when you're podcasting as we are, or if you're in a movie and your line is coming up, you're thinking about, okay, as soon as he says this, my reaction has got to be this. So it's not easy. It is really multitasking to remember your own lines, be ready to give them when you're supposed to give them, but also react to what he's saying now. And I think, you know, to some extent that goes with just learning your lines so well that you don't, you know, they're coming out of you as second nature, so that it allows you to focus on the other thing. But I still think it's not easy. And especially, you know, you hear about some of these actors who use cue cards on the scene, you know, as they're filming. That person obviously doesn't know all their lines if they need cue cards. And, you know, to combine everything, it's not easy. I think it's a tougher task than people will give credit for. Not because people don't want to give credit, but because people don't see it. Well, people mm-hmm. don't, it doesn't register. I think you do see it, and I think it does make a difference, but it doesn't register. I think I'm saying that right now. So I think that's important. I think Paul Newman always does that, frankly. And I'm just not as familiar with Redford's work as I am Paul Newman's. So that's why I think I'm focusing more on him and in this movie, because between this movie and The Sting, and again, we're not going to talk about that, but I really feel like I saw a lot as far as his acting ability that I hadn't really registered before.
I think it's also an example of, I think there's certain actors that are students of the game. And I feel like when you're on screen with somebody like Paul Newman, you either embrace it and learn from the experience and grow, or you don't. And I felt like the reason why they worked so well off each other is because of the fact that there was a clear respect for, at least to just view that way as, for me as a viewer, of each other as acting talent. I think the act of listening you were mentioning with Redford before was because he was doing that on set. I think, you know, he was like looking at how he was acting out this scene. He was playing off it, feeling it. I think when you can do that with somebody you're partnered with on screen, we know those magic roles where you see people playing off each other, there's something about them. And it was very clear he was doing it. It was very clear he respected Newman. And I've seen the two of them. There was something I just saw recently where it was the two of them on a stage show and they were acting out some scenes together on stage. You know, it was more meant to be like an anniversary kind of get together kind of thing. And, it was very, very clear that these are two guys who have respected each other throughout their entire lives. And I think it comes from doing work like this, where they clearly grew together, acting together in this. The thing I respected the most about this is I felt like this is a role I have not seen from Robert Redford. I can't pretend I've watched everything in Robert Redford's catalog, but I've seen a decent amount of Robert Redford's work. Remember, I was the one who was like saying, I really want to do The Natural on the podcast because of it. So I really like Redford as an actor. But this role, what I loved about it was this feels very, very different than other things that I've seen him in and shows acting range. And I feel like some of that does come from who he's acting with as well. You know, and the fact that he was willing to learn and play off and develop an atmosphere in this film with the other person that he's working with, which is impressive to me. He didn't get overtaken and overshadowed by Paul Newman, which is something I'm assuming is probably very easy to have happen if you're in a film with Paul Newman, because Paul Newman is amazing.
He's a presence.
Yes, exactly. So the fact that you can be in the film and feel like you're on an equal level with Paul Newman in the film, I think says a lot about his ability to interact and navigate with somebody who's that much of a presence.
And again, I'm going to periodically bring up this thing, but we're not going to get into the review on that yet. But if somebody is watching both movies, mm-hmm. look at the dynamic of the relationship between the two, because they are very, very different. In The Sting, just briefly, you know, Paul Newman is the seasoned, older guy, whereas Robert Redford is the young, hot-headed guy, and he's learning from his mentor. It's a mentor-mentee relationship, clearly. So pushing that aside, in this movie, Butch Cassidy is the leader of the Hole in the Wall gang. Sundance Kid is not. So there's a leadership dynamic there. But despite that leadership dynamic, clearly they are equals. There is no he's in charge and you follow. He is in charge. Butch Cassidy is in charge of the Hole in the Wall gang, and that gets challenged. And we should probably talk about that scene because that's one of my favorites. Yes, Lurch. you know, he's in charge of the Hole in the Wall gang, and it even comes up during that scene when, you know, in fact, let's talk a little bit about that scene, because I think that goes into the dynamic. You know, Butch Cassidy's role as the leader is being challenged, and they say, you know, you always said any of us could challenge you. That's because I thought none of you would ever do it. but when they're facing off, now the challenge comes from Harvey Logan, who's huge. He's played by Ted Cassidy, who played Lurch in The Addams Family, and is clearly in top physical shape at this point. You know, he takes off his shirt to fight with Butch, and you know, you could see he's not somebody you'd want to mess with. And even he has a little bit of a fear of the Sundance Kid, because he's you know, as soon as it comes up, it clearly comes into his mind. He says, "This doesn't concern you." You know, like he's making sure that he doesn't get involved. And then, you know, he says something to Butch about, you know, keep him out of this or whatever. And he goes his own way, like always, meaning he isn't really a part of the Hole in the Wall gang. He's kind of with them. He's Butch's partner, but he's not a part of the Hole in the Wall gang, really.
I like that Logan, though, to the point of the fear of him, is sitting there saying, yeah, and you can stay with us still.
Yeah. And then that's one of the great comedy moments. And, you know, the comedy is more subtle, but there is definitely a fair amount of comedy in here where he says, not for nothing, but when this is over, if I'm dead, kill him. And Sundance says, love to. And then he looks over and gives him like a smile and waves.
It was great. It was such a, that sequence, everything about that sequence was perfect.
And it goes back to that first time when I recorded it. The censors at the time, when he says 1, 2, 3, go, and then it cuts right to Logan kind of on the floor. It cuts to Butch punching him, you know, when he does the double fist punch. They don't show him kicking him in the nuts, which, you know, now I don't think they think twice about leaving that on TV, but at the time they cut that out.
And what it was so good at showing you is that Butch is, as far as physical presence, Logan should easily trounce him. Butch is an opportunist. Butch is crafty. Butch has to use his smarts in order to get ahead in a situation. And I love that that needed to happen for Butch, you know, as far as getting the gang back under control. I also love the reality of the fact that that would not be the last time that something like that would happen if the gang kept going. Just because that's the nature of those relationships, right? There's an advantage to being the boss. There's an advantage to, and I could see as the gang morphs, because gangs like that, well, you've got certain members right now. I like the reality of the fact that, of course, he's like, I want to be the boss right now because I've got some ideas on how to make big money and how to make that money for me. So why wouldn't I, you know, take this point? And I'm the biggest guy here. The presence of Logan, you know, Ted Cassidy, woof, I mean, ripped. I mean, you mentioned Lurch before. Obviously, I've seen him as Lurch for years. But when you see him in this, I mean, talk about a presence, a physical presence on the screen. He looks intimidating, and I love that.
I'm just going to throw in on the side note, I'm pretty sure in the old Fantastic Four cartoon from the 1960s, the voice of Galactus.
Oh, wow. Oh, that'd be great. And honestly, the voice would make sense. His voice is distinctive.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Now, one of the things I really liked about that scene, when you're looking at it a little closer, is just the relationship between Butch and the Hole in the Wall gang. Now, mm-hmm. I did confirm that the Hole in the Wall gang was a real thing. There was a news carver. There was a flat nose, whatever, that these people really did exist. When they mention about him, you know, being challenged for the leadership, he says, "But you picked Logan." And the response, I think, speaks volumes, where he said, "Well, at least he's here all the time." It's almost like Butch is an absentee father to these people. So it gives a little bit more depth to that relationship, which we don't get to see a lot of, but we see enough there that, you know, they depend on him and they rely on him to kind of lead them, that they're, you know, none of them are leaders except for Logan. And I like the fact that when all is said and done, Butch is open-minded enough that he hears the plan and he says, you know, "Logan thought of that? Let's do that." Because he was totally against the idea of robbing the train until he was explaining the logic, which he had not considered. So I thought that was, you know, that was a good scene on different levels, which is, you know, not just the humor.
It's rather ironic, though, that Logan's plan is ultimately their undoing.
Yes.
Because the Absolutely. Fact that they start robbing these trains, it like sets them up for, you know, where things end up going. But there's a great picture. If you go to IMDb and you click on Timothy Scott, you'll see like some of his pictures from his roles. There's a great picture of the whole gang together. It looks like they were posing for a shot, but it's them mm-hmm. all in costume, you know, on the set. And it's just a great shot of every member of the gang. So if you're listening to this, go to IMDb and click on Timothy Scott, who played News Carver, and you'll see this great picture of the gang, which I think just they look like they're a gang in all the right ways. I mean, it was a very, very good scene, because really with where this film goes and the fact that the gang has an active role during these initial robberies, but they aren't together for the rest of the film, because this very much becomes a three-person, then a two-person show, you know, as far as who the characters are that we're really following. I love the fact that the gang was established, because it gave the sense of who they are, why they end up being on the run, and what that dynamic looked like. If the gang didn't have this moment, they wouldn't have felt real. And I felt like this was really important. This film does a great job of giving you this sense of a living, thriving, breathing world. And that's something where it feels very, very three-dimensional, whereas these could have been very flat scenes, if I'm making any sense at all. And I love the fact that this world, the opening scene, when we mentioned the card scene with Robert Redford, and that type of thing, that added a sense of, what does this world look like? What do these guys do when they're not robbing trains and robbing banks? And I loved all of that and what that looks like.
And that scene, I thought there was the directorial choice that I think really works well, is that, you know, it starts in the sepia tones. Mm-hmm. And I think it just shows some of the dreariness. You know, they don't really show how hard life is at that time as compared to now. You know, my sister used to comment, one of my favorite movies is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And my sister used to comment about, "Oh, everybody's so sweaty and dirty." And I said, "But that's realistic. You don't see that in most of the Hollywood Westerns. Usually, you know, the life looks pretty comfortable to these people." And it does in this one, too. But I think that scene, just that darkness, it gives you this feeling of the smokiness and all of that. And then the scene ends, and as they're riding away, all of a sudden color starts coming into the picture, and you see the vistas and the backgrounds. And I think it changes the tone, and it also just kind of gives you a good feeling going, you know, as to where things are. You know, the era and what's going on. So I just thought that was a really cool choice.
I agree with you. And it also worked off the film reels in the beginning, you know, where they were set in the sense that this is really old. I mean, it's, you know, we're taking a step back in time. They were using those film reels in the very, very beginning when they were doing the credits and everything. And I feel it worked really, really well to not drastically jump into the colors, but to keep that kind of tone into that scene. I think that was an excellent choice, because it did give me a sense of time placement for this film, which is something you don't necessarily always need, but I appreciated because it really did a lot. Atmosphere for this film really is strong.
Yeah, agreed. After they agree to take on the train robberies, and what you say is true, because it does ultimately become their downfall, I think you have some good comedy as that's going on between the interaction of Butch and Woodcock. When the woman comes and is yelling at them, and they use her as a way to get him to open up the train. There's a lot of little things there, but even that interaction just shows you the charismatic nature of Butch Cassidy in this movie. I don't know in real life what it was like, but you know, where he actually develops a kind of an almost friendship with the guy who he who he's robbing and who he almost kills. And then you have, you think you used enough dynamite there, Butch? There's some humorous things in there, and it's just really cool. And then we go from that to the Super Posse.
Yes.
Which is a great transition. The one thing about the Super Posse scenes, well, I'm going to start with just when they first appear. I think that's an excellently directed scene too. When that train pulls up and then the whistle goes, it's just building the tension. Then the doors open up and these horses come bursting out after them. And you get the sense of, boy, they better get moving fast, that scene is interesting because they could not film it in real life the way it is, because that can't happen. The horses can't go from at a standstill inside the train to an out-and-out gallop like they are there. So what they had to do was they had to build a ramp going up into the train, and they get the horses into a run, and they just run right through the train. And that's the way they filmed it, and it's extremely effective.
It very much looks like they're jumping right out of the train and ready to go.
Yeah, which is, again, it's not possible.
Right. But I love that they made it look like that, because it looked very authentic, even though it's not.
Yeah, and it serves its exact purpose by upping the tension of the scene.
It also gives a sense that this Super Posse is, these are like top tier talent. This is not just a bunch of guys who've gotten together and they're chasing, because the towns were having trouble, getting together anybody to rally against them. And I think it was good to have that sequence beforehand where, you got the guy who's like trying to rally everyone together and can't get a single person to help him out. Then you've got the Super Posse and they're doing things that shouldn't be possible. It really contrasted very, very well.
Well, and the fact, going to what you said about the fact that they couldn't put together a regular posse of people, it's because, the posse they're looking together is volunteers. And mm-hmm. The volunteers are saying to themselves, well, why should I put my life on the line? They're not affecting me. I don't have any, and that goes to kind of, Butch Cassidy being Robin Hood, steals from the rich and gives to the poor. Because they even have the scene where, Ed is telling him how Sundance says, you're a soft touch. You get the money, you're buying drinks for everybody, and you spend it as quickly as you make it. So it's like the regular people aren't going to go after Robin Hood. They're not going to go after Butch Cassidy either.
Right, right.
So, I think that speaks to the characters as well. And the reason this posse, this super posse, is after them is because they're being paid. When they eventually, as they're going on, they kind of figure out who the guys are, and they're like, well, they don't usually leave this area, but they're being paid enough, and they're being paid until the job is done, and they are relentless. And that not only does the tension of them coming after them become initially apparent, as it's going on, their relentlessness becomes apparent. But the one thing we see that I kind of felt like was the slightest of a misstep in there is there doesn't seem to be any remorse or bother to the fact that some of the hole in the wall get killed there. You know, a couple of them get shot and killed, and there's like really no reaction from Butch or Sundance. And I don't expect Sundance to have a reaction because he's not really a part of things. But I would have liked to have seen just something from Butch there that it bothered him, that people under his, under his control got killed with the choices that were made.
And I can't help but wonder if the thinking there, if there was, you know, some form of thinking there, was just this idea that really they're a means to the end versus being, but it doesn't match Butch's character. And that's where I'm agreeing with you, because of the fact that I feel like with Butch's character, he does care. He likes people. It's very clear Butch likes people. He likes people more than Sundance likes people.
Oh, absolutely. Not even close.
Yeah. I mean, but it's really one of those things where I think Butch wants everybody to a certain extent, even Woodcock, to like him.
Yeah.
I think a great thing with it. The sequence where the super posse is chasing them and they're identifying gradually. And that's, I think that was a key too, who some of the players are in the super posse. I loved that it was coming out of the fact that they were doing, basically pulling every trick out of their playbook to hide their trail. And they kept getting discovered along the way. And nothing was working. None of their plans. They were sure they found another plan. Let's get the horses. Let's send the horses off. And yet the super posse is still coming. Everything that they were doing to try and hide their trail was being quickly discovered. And I loved that we got to know who that super posse was, not by just a quick rattling off of them. It was as things were failing, they kept asking the questions out of desperation.
Who are those guys?
Yeah, exactly. The identification of the straw hat, the identification of the tracker. I think all of those things just worked really, really well to further enhance the danger we'd already seen from the super posse. I thought that was just really, really strong writing. And actually, again, strong acting on Butch and Sundance, who were making us feel that these were next level guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we have the fact that when they're in Bolivia, they see the straw hat.
Yeah.
So they know, you know, this isn't, we can't just walk away from this. And it does kind of go to the inevitability of what ends up happening, which, you know, again, I feel like it's kind of foretold throughout the film. Even though the film is lighthearted, you know, the ending is foretold. The scene when they jump off the cliff, that's iconic. That's one of the, like, to me, the best known scenes ever. In filmmaking, that's, you know, when they do these montage things where they show great scenes from movies, that one seems to be in there all the time, and the acting is perfect, and the tension of it is perfect, you know, and they both do a wonderful job with it. You know, Sundance being reticent to admit that he can't swim, but then ultimately saying it, but you know, I want to fight him, that whole thing, and then just when Butch realizes what's going on, he starts laughing. Well, hell, the fall will probably kill you. You know, that whole thing. It's just so well done that to me, again, that's one of the best scenes ever in filmmaking.
It's an example of balanced humor, too, because you're mentioning some of the humor before they jump. But then when they're going down the water, you know, when they're being pulled by the rapids, and there's some joking between the two of them during that. It was not overdone. I love that there's some lighthearted humor in this, but it never takes away from the atmosphere or the danger.
It never goes into farce.
Yes, yes, exactly. And it's really, really strong choices that are there, because that, again, adds to the sense of these are friends, which actually further your criticism before of wasn't there at least some reaction to what happened to the gang? The fact that they are those people says something. I found that they were very likable. And that's really important when you are in a movie that becomes a them escaping, a chase scene. And you want them to get away. You know, it's not about whether they do or they don't. It's that you want it because you like them enough that you want them to escape. Based on who they are and what they did, you kind of shouldn't want them to escape. You know, from a legal standpoint, kind of should want them to get caught. It's the opposite. You're rooting for them to get away and to have a happily ever after out of all this piece, or you know, just the sense that they're somewhere scheming still.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, they are anti-heroes. And you know, when film or TV show shows an anti-hero, you should feel torn, I think.
Yeah.
Between your morality, knowing that these people are bad people and they should get what's coming to them, and your personality part where you say, well, but I like them. you've seen it much, much more in recent days. But back then, you know, again, you had Bonnie and Clyde, I think, which is very similar in its presentation, where you like them, but you know, ultimately they need to get their comeuppance. So, you know, from that point forward, this becomes kind of a chase movie, even to the end, because again, you know, they see the Panama hat in Bolivia, and they know that this is not going to end without them doing something. That's when he comes up with the idea, we're going to go to Australia. They speak English there. You know, there's still stuff, you know, to the very, very end where there's still comedy coming in. You know, they're ready to face their final stand. You know, Sundance is telling them, I don't want to hear your ideas. And then Butch says it anyway. So I thought you wanted to know. You know, there's still some comedy. And it's one of the things where the comedy isn't, like I said, it's not farcical. The comedy is played more in amusing lines, but how they are presented, that lesser actors would give those same lines and they wouldn't seem as amusing as they are given by these two. So, you know, that certainly adds to the movie a lot. I think we should talk a little bit. Did you have something you were going to say?
The other piece I want to mention are the set pieces. You mentioned the cinematography before and just how that added to the atmosphere, and there were some really good cinematography choices. I would add that building off that cinematography, they did a very good job of hiding the set pieces. And what I mean by that is sometimes when you watch these films, it's very clear something is a set. It's not real. It's not there. I didn't get that feeling during this, which is something, you know, there's, you know, clearly not everything they're viewing is an actual location. But they did because they're showing vast areas and things like that. And I feel like they did a very, very good job. I mean, we're talking 2025 right now. I'm watching this film. And there was not, I mean, there's a couple of areas that I'd have to really think to where I was recognizing that we were on a set versus an actual real breathing location. And that to me is also attributed to just really strong cinematography to hide some of the trickery you need to do during that time in order to give you a sense of this is a sprawling vast location. Because that chase, if you don't feel like they're traveling long distances during that chase, something's going to get lost there. All of that. And when they get to, when they're in towns, the towns feel real, breathing, living, thriving. There was never a point in time where the set piece was taking me out of the reality of what I was experiencing there. And that's, we're talking about a film from 1969. To be watching that now and looking at that and going, wow, they transported me there. That is something that is really stunning to be able to say right now. And they did a very, very good job with set pieces to the point that it would still hold up to today, because our cameras, our 4K, you know, be able to watch, we see that stuff a lot easier now. The stuff they were hiding back then, we see a lot easier. This film, there is not a lot that pops out that makes you, takes away from that sense of disbelief.
To that end, this did win Best Cinematography in the Academy Awards that year. So you're right on the money. It also won Best Original Score and Best Song. Now, I love Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. I still love that song to this day. There was some controversy over that being included in the movie because it is so anachronistic that it's, you know, it loses a little feel of the time. And I think Redford, if I remember reading this, that he was critical of it because there's no rain in the scene. You know, what's up with raindrops keep falling on my head when there's no rain? And I from what I heard, is he criticized that a little bit, but then he kind of redacted his criticism and said, no, you know what, I was wrong. I do think that that song, the tone of that song, fits the scene so well. It is anachronistic. It's not indicative of, you know, whatever it is, the 1890s or whatever time this takes place. But it's a great song. It's a great scene. So the other filmmaking thing I heard about that particular scene, and I think this is correct, and this would not happen today. They would not do this today. They'd just CGI it, I'm sure. The scene with the bull, while that song is going on, you know, they needed to have the bull chase after Butch. And apparently this bull was very docile, and they were having a tough time with it. And the way they got it to run was by spraying something akin to Tabasco sauce on its testicles. So that would be a cruelty to animals thing that would not happen today.
Yes, they would not. They would not do that today at all.
Yeah.
So. Actually, come to think of it, I'm sure there's not that disclaimer that we see now that no animals were harmed in the making of this film.
Yeah, I'm sure there's not.
That disclaimer on there. We're used to seeing that in today's film. I'm guaranteeing we're not seeing that on this one.
But where I love the raindrops keep falling on my head sequence, I am not a fan, or even close to a fan. I am kind of actively disliking the montage music with the chorus kind of la-la-lying through the whole thing. I didn't like that music at all. It went on too long. The montage didn't go on too long. That music went on too long. Yeah. It kind of irritated me as it went on. So that, to me, it was a negative in this movie. And for that reason, I'm a little surprised that it won Best Score. But
yeah, the score is funny. The score isn't something like some of the music I like, but some of it tonally lost something for me on this. And I think it's a testament to how great the film is, the fact that it didn't lose the experience of the film for me. But I'm agreeing with everything you're saying, because I was like, I kind of agree with Redford and the raindrops keep falling on my head.
That would just be a matter of saying, you know, could you change these lyrics a little bit to not have a raindrops on it? But whatever. I think it's a great song, though. And like I said, I think the sequence fits really well. And if you're not sitting thinking about what the words are necessarily.
Yes.
I think the whole aspect of it, and, if you go into the late 60s, early 70s, the part of it, it's because I'm free, nothing's worrying me. Like, that whole part of it is supposed to set the tone for the scene.
And that does work. That part does work.
Looking back, I'm a little surprised at one Best Score, because honestly, if you eliminate those two musical sequences, there's precious little music in this movie. There's not a lot of background music at all. There's some.
Do we know what it went up against?
Not offhand, and I won't be able to quickly click on it and find out. So
I'm just wondering if that's something I'm going to check after this. I'd just be curious to see what it went up against. Maybe that gives some more, like, why.
Very possible that there may not have been strong competition. I don't know. And it's Best Score non-musical. So, if there were musicals that came out that year, they wouldn't be in competition with it.
Sure.
I thought the direction was top notch. I really don't have a lot to criticize or to say of a negative nature at all. George Roy Hill, besides doing this and The Sting, let's see what we have here. Well, he did the. I think, he did other movies that I've heard of before this, but nothing else that was significant. After this, he did Slaughterhouse-Five, then The Sting, then The Great Waldo Pepper with Robert Redford, then Slapshot with Paul Newman. He also did The World According to Garp, which is an underrated movie, in my opinion.
It is, yes.
And his career ended on Funny Farm with Chevy Chase. So not a huge filmography, but some notable movies in there. Mm-hmm. Do we have anything else to add on this?
I don't think so.
Just a note on the George Roy Hill. He was nominated for Best Director for this movie, but did not win.
And should have. Well, I should.
Well, unless we know the competition, I can't say.
Yeah.
And I didn't.
Definitely deserve the nomination.
Does it have? Let me just see if it tells me on here if I click on this one link. Okay. Yes. So, Best Director. John Schlesinger won for Midnight Cowboy, which I think this was a better job than that, honestly. The other nominees were Arthur Penn for Alice's Restaurant, Sidney Pollack for They Shoot Horses, Don't They, and Costa Gavras for Z. I'm going to say he should have won for this.
Yeah. And definitely deserve the nomination. At the very least, you sit there and go, does somebody deserve a nomination for it? 1,000% deserve the nomination.
Okay, so now Best Original Music Score for a Motion Picture, Not a Musical. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid won for Burt Bacharach. The competition was Anne of a Thousand Days, which I don't know. The Reavers, which I don't know, but it was John Williams. The Secret of Santa Vittoria, which I also don't know. And The Wild Bunch. I kind of remember The Wild Bunch score as being very good for the movie. Like I said, not necessarily something that I'd want to listen to in the car, but I think that may have been a better score because, again, this not that this was a bad score, but it wasn't a particularly present score. There's a lot of scenes with no music whatsoever, and I don't know that this should have stood out, but whatever the case may be, it won. And I guess we could rate this now. In my own personal viewing, this is one of my favorite movies ever. You know, as is a geek thing, there have been many times where I've said, oh, I'm going to list my top 25 movies of all time. This is almost universally on the list. There was a point where, you know, The Godfather's kind of had the number one slot on my list forever, but there was a time where this was number two on my list. I don't think it's quite as high as that anymore, but it was that high. So in my own personal tastes, this movie is Jaws. Watching it with my wife, seeing it through 2025 eyes for somebody who never saw it before, who isn't a huge movie fan, but likes movies, she was almost indifferent at points during it because the story didn't totally pull her in the way I had hoped it would. And we'll get to The Sting later, but we've watched both of them together. She had seen neither. She clearly enjoyed The Sting a lot more than she enjoyed this. So I did see where this movie was slower at points, that if you weren't entrenched in it, where you might be a little bored by certain scenes because they were character moments that were a little slower moving. So I think this movie kind of straddles the line between Jaws 2 and Jaws, frankly, because of that. I think had I watched it without my wife, I would have rated it as a Jaws. But I have to take her opinions into account because I did see the validity of what she was saying. So I'm going to say it's either a very high Jaws 2 or a low Jaws.
You have to take your wife's opinion because of the fact that you're trying to give yourself a rating off of that. I watched it with my wife too. My wife was entrenched in it, actually. And I think it's an example of a film that you're either going to get locked in or you're not. I think if you get locked into it, there's not a wasted scene because I don't know what you can cut out of this film. You know what I mean? I think it's one of those things. If you're in and you're on board to it, everything that's character development, everything that's in there is important to the film. And I think that was something that was very well done from this one. I agree with you on the, you know, skirting the line between Jaws and Jaws 2. I'm going to say in 2025, though, for myself, what makes it a Jaws, I think there's certain films that you should see if you are taking a look at film, want to know about great film, classic film. This is a film from 1969. I watched it in 2025. The only thing I regretted was that I wasn't watching it on the big screen. If you've listened to this for any point in time since I've been on it, I'm a big, big screen fan. And I feel like there's something to the movie theater experience. I would love to. And we're fortunate here that we have a Cinematheque that every so often will run classic movies. And I'm hoping they get Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, because I'd love to see this on the big screen. Just because of the fact that just to be able to feel it and experience it the way that it was originally intended. This was amazing. I can't believe it took me this long to see it. I'm glad that we decided to do some of these films now, but it's great to see this film and be able to appreciate it now. All I can say is I've watched it twice now. I can't wait to watch it again, which says something about a film. When you know what's going to happen and you know where everything's going to go, but you like the atmosphere, tone, and mood so much that you want to keep coming back to it. I think if you have not seen this one, you need to put this on the list. You can't miss this one.
Surprisingly, this movie was not particularly well received by critics. A lot of times I just go to Siskel and Ebert, and apparently they didn't really care for it that much. Ebert gave it 2.5 out of 4 stars. I'm going to see if I could find on YouTube, when they reviewed it, and I'll put it at the end of the podcast if I could find it. But it's interesting that they seem to be surprised. I'm just looking here. Ebert thought the quality declined after Harriman hires the posse. Hill apparently spent a lot of money to take his company on location for these scenes, and I guess when he got back to Hollywood, he couldn't bear to edit them out of the final version. So the super posse chases our hero unceasingly until we've long since forgotten how well the movie started. That was Ebert. Siskel said he thought it was predictable and that it was too cute to be believed, not memorable. Siskel later admitted in 1989 that publishing his negative review was one of his first challenges as a film critic, recalling that the editorial assistant was shocked that he gave a bad review to a film starring Paul Newman and would give him a lesson that he had to be honest as a critic, no matter how unpopular his opinion. So it's interesting.
I don't agree with the opinion, but I give him credit for giving the opinion. I think it's fun to hear opinions. I disagree with him because I feel like the fact when they're being chased by the posse was exciting. So it's interesting that he looked at that as a decline of the film, where I felt like everything was building towards that.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I always say I enjoy contrasting opinions with my own when they are presented in a respectful manner. And certainly they have every right to their opinions, and I respect them as critics. I think they certainly have more credibility as critics than I do. So I shouldn't necessarily just dismiss what they say, even when I disagree with them. Anyway.
Well, when I watched their show back in the day, it was just as fun to watch it when I disagreed with them as when I agreed with them.
Absolutely. I mourn their loss because I used to enjoy watching it very much. But thank you everybody for listening to us, and, we'll be doing The Sting sometime in the not too distant future if you want to watch that. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
But Robert Redford truly deserved that star billing after he made Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in 1969. Redford and Paul Newman created one of the most famous pairings in movie history. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was a film whose outlaw personalities perfectly suited the anarchic spirit of the late 1960s. And it was the first of many films that demonstrated Redford's almost uncanny ability to pick projects in sync with the mood of the time.
I think it's interesting to try and figure out why this was the film that catapulted him into superstardom. And I think one of the things had to do with he held his own against Paul Newman. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he seemed younger than Paul Newman. And I think that people were saying, hey, who is this other guy? I adore Newman, and here's this other guy, and he's even more glamorous.
I was on the set of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid when they were making it. It was the first time I met either Paul Newman or Robert Redford. And at the time, there was a feeling that the film was going to go right into the basement. It was a Western. Mm-hmm. Everybody was going to Easy Rider. They were going to 2001. Yeah. It seemed like it was completely out of its time, and that's why it surprised people so much that Butch and Sundance, the Sundance Kid, seemed very contemporary when the movie came out.
I think that you mentioned Easy Rider. I think if you can think about the film as sort of a mainstream version of Easy Rider, the two rebels, and here is something that's more palatable for the mainstream culture, and it was a mainstream hit.